How have you found time to do everything that you've done?
You mean in the past? Or mean now? What do you mean?
You've headed so many commissions, you've done so many things that you seem to have wrapped up in a lifetime more than what 20 people could do in a lifetime.
Well, I don't know about that. But if you mean have I collected hats, no. I don't care about that at all. What you find when you get into public works particularly is that one thing leads to another. In other words, you get into one field and you find it overlaps on another one in order to accomplish something in the first. You have to take on the second, and the second leads to a third. And pretty soon you're in a whole lot of things. It isn't as though you sit out to see how many jobs could I hold at the same time. That kind of vanity is stupid. But there's a logic in these things. It may be that, of course, that you take on too much. But I think it's been a definite logic as far as public works are concerned in the various jobs, the various responsibilities I've taken on.
I have
no interest in titles as such. I have no interest in getting
a little closer to
temporary prominence or something of that kind.
Do you consider yourself a public servant, or do you consider yourself a man simply seeking to fulfill a given job?
No. Of course I consider myself a public servant. Anybody who takes an oath of office is a public servant. Of course. You mean if you're stressing the word servant, is that what you mean?
Do you believe that you sort of have a duty to fulfill these.
You mean the call? The call from on high? No, I don't feel it. I'm not that kind of fellow. I don't get messages. Those are just wrong numbers.
You involved yourself directly into politics at one time, I believe.
Ran for governor. Those were excursions. Those were... Not objectives. They're things you get into, you're sort of forced into. You mean elective office?
You ran in 1934
for government. I was dragooned into that. I was pressured into it. It was a mistake, I think, as I look back on it. On the other hand, when I might have been mayor, when LaGuardia was nominated, in the fusion committee, I had 23 votes, and I think I had 18 votes, and he had 5. But Seabury was then in charge of the thing, and he hated Smith's guts, and he hated anybody that was associated with Smith. And I fell under that ban, and he said that if they nominated me, he would come out for somebody else. So at that time, I might have been nominated. I don't know what I could have done with the mayoralty. A shot at it. So I went with LaGuardia asked me to come with him, and I enjoyed my contacts with him immensely. I guess I was the only person who had a position of any, or positions of any consequence who lasted through his 3 terms. There were people who were there during the 3 terms, but they were not in top positions. And in spite of all the fights I had with him, I was with him until the end. I think he was the best mayor we had, certainly in my time. All his peculiarities and antics, remarkable fellow. He wasn't in the class with Smith as an executive, not in the same league.
You miss not having a shot at elective office? Are you sorry that it never...
At what?
At elective office. Are you sorry that never...
No. I don't care for elective office anyway, as such. I'd much rather have a specific, definite, limited job to do and do it and keep out of the limelight, so-called, the publicity end of it, except to the extent that you have to get into it. It's part of the game.
If you had one project that you completed stands out in your mind as the most successful or the most
important power work, what
would that be?
The power work was the most satisfactory because I finally got in a position to work independently and without unnecessary obstacles in the way, with support from the top people, and had the same kind of persons to deal with in Canada. That was a great piece of good fortune. Otherwise, Jones Beach, a lot of other things that I enjoyed doing, working on.
I was reading an excerpt from your book in which Simple Man Louis DeSalvio called you a stubborn old man with regard to your proposal for a cross Manhattan expressway. This is one project of yours that never came about.
Well, I'll tell you whom you should ask about that if you want to have some fun. Ask David Rockefeller what happened. Ask him to explain it. Be interested. He's a friend of mine. What happened was this. To begin with, you know DeSalvio's record, you know his past. Well,
no,
if you don't know that, you don't know the story. He was the son of a well-known, very curious character. He was a lightweight boxer. And he called himself Jimmy Kelly. If you look up the records, the books, you'll find that Jimmy Kelly was DeSalvio's father. Salvio got to be a leader in that area. And he wanted to keep his constituency together. That's the whole secret of it. He had no interest in the larger aspects of this thing. Now, coming to the reasoning, you don't for a moment think that isn't going to be built. Of course it's going to be built. It's going to cost 8-10 times as much and cause an endless amount of difficulty. It'll be built because the logic necessity calls for it. Now, one of the things that happened down there was that the Chase Bank and its affiliates and associates was uncertain as to whether to stay downtown and spread and get into what would inevitably be a reconstruction of Lower Manhattan or move to Midtown Manhattan. I knew that was going on, as anybody in any kind of public work knows about it, and anybody who knew had a passing acquaintance with the bank people and Rockefellers. But David asked me to discuss this whole thing at length with him and his associates. The invitation came from him. He'll tell you that if you ask him. There isn't any doubt about that. And I said I thought that they should stay downtown. Now, don't misunderstand me. I don't say I cast the final vote or that my reasoning was necessarily very persuasive. I merely tell you what happened. Well, I said, if you get into this thing, you've taken on a hell of a job, my fine friend. And one of the most difficult parts of it has to do, the two most difficult things are, first of all, transportation, parking, cars, and secondly, housing. So we went into this pretty thoroughly, and they decided to stay there. There were some things that they agreed to do, some of which they did and some they didn't. When I say agreed to do, said they thought of doing. I went into this cross Manhattan thing very thoroughly with him. I said, you've got to have that, bearing in mind that you're on the way. You're on the east side leading to the west side. You have the bridges, you have the tunnel. There has to be another tunnel. And I'd had something to do with the tunnel building. Going way back, I was Governor Smith's assistant and carried his papers in his briefcase when he was a member of the Port Authority between his first and second terms. He was a very influential member. He was wherever he served. And we talked about another tube on the tunnel to New Jersey. And Then along comes this fella with his howling and screaming about disturbing the area. The area was and still is one of the worst in New York. If you don't believe that, go down there and go through the buildings. Don't listen to anybody else. If you feel that you're not safe, and you may very well not be safe, go with a building fella, somebody, a policeman and a fireman, or just a policeman and a fireman. Get yourself protected a little. My boys and I went through everything down there. We do that, you know.
And what the specific part?
I'm talking about, you're talking about the crossing, aren't
yes,
you?
But
well, that's what I'm talking about.
But I know that. But what specific area, where was this to cross? Where is this to cross in Lower Manhattan?
Well, there's no secret about that. There's a time you said you were reading the book. You can find out where it was. Went in the main from one of the bridges, connected with all of the bridges, but in the main, it went from one of the East River bridges across to the tunnel to New Jersey. And David tried to do something about it, but I think he got worried about this opposition. Well, I said, I'll tell you what we'll do. We'll build a housing project for these people who have to be moved. We'll make it part of the cost of this crossing. We actually acquired the land. This was no gesture. This wasn't any goo-goo stuff. Well, they didn't want it. The political pressure was terrific for a small neighborhood of a relatively small number of people involved. And they succeeded in holding the thing up. But you don't think for a minute, if you look at that, it isn't going to be built. It has to be built. They're up against it now. They're up against the West Side improvement now. And these things that are logical, these things that represent intelligent, honest planning, they happen. They have to happen. They're inevitable. They're unavoidable. You can postpone them. So what? Ask David how this came about.
Tell me about Al Smith and your association with him.
Tell him about him. Well, I've written everything. You got a little brochure there.
I want you to tell me for
what's that?
I want you to tell me for my take.
Well, you've got all the literature. I mean, you don't want me to give you a biography of Smith to you.
I want you to tell me about him and how you viewed him and your relationship.
Well, I think he was I think he was the greatest Democratic with a small D executive that I ran into. I had no affiliations with him in the beginning, none whatever. I went, met him in connection with reorganizing state government and got to know him very well and was in his administrations in one capacity or another, assistant, deckhand, advisor, if you like that better. Now, if you ask me whether he would have been a good president, I think he would, yes. I can't prove that because he had no particular background for it, but who did? A very unusual qualities. One thing that stood him in very good stead was the fact that he had a prodigious memory. He's not a reader, but his stuff from talking to people. He didn't write stuff. A number of times people come to me and say, you must have a hell of a lot of correspondence with the governor. I say, where are your papers? I said, I don't know where they are, in Columbia or in the library or someplace. No, I don't have any. I don't have any correspondence. Well, he said, that's absurd. I said, it may be absurd to you, but it happens to be a fact. He talked over the telephone. Occasional memorandum that says, hey, yes, something or other. You don't have any correspondence with him. Yeah, didn't write letters. A lot of people, of course, most people, write letters for the record. You know that. Subsequent record. They have libraries named after presidents and all that kind of thing. And you have the feeling, not in all cases, I'm not being cynical about it, but an awful lot of that letter writing is for the files, you know. Subsequent usage.
Tell me about Central Park and what's happening to the park today.
Oh, it's in dreadful shape. I have written a piece. It's a very funny story. At least I think it's funny. I'll tell you how this came about. Several people talked to me about a anniversary of the Central Park fellow, who's best known to the public, and Olmsted. Would I write a piece about it? I said, well, it isn't 100th anniversary. What is it, 150? Well, you can make an anniversary out of anything. So I was told by all of these people, one after another, that this was the greatest man in long-range physical planning in modern history, which is something I did not subscribe to. So I immediately found that there was a fanatical coterie of people. This fellow had a backing, landscape architects, who, of course, notoriously, especially the Birdbath landscape architect, notorious for words, you know, and aesthetics and all that kind of thing. So I find myself arguing with these people, and I said, why would I say that he wasn't a great man? I say he was a great man. You want me to say that he was a great long-distance planner in the sense of regionalism, we'll say. No, I don't go for that. Well, will you write the thing for us? I don't think so. I don't know what you'd do with it. So I finally talked to some people about it, and they said, now listen, you're an honorary member of the Society of the American Landscape Architects. You've got to write it for their magazine. I said, you've got something there, kid. But I said, I'll tell you something. They won't print it. Not the way I write it. Not a chance. But I said, just for fun, just for the hell of it, I'll write these fellows. And I'll give them some kind of an outline or a draft. Well, the fellow, I'm not going to characterize people's personalities in the thing, but the fellow who got this thing, editor of the magazine, was scared stiff, you could see that. He didn't know what to do. So this fellow, kind of a son of a bitch, but he's got a lot of friends, and you can't just laugh him off. And you can't say that this Olmsted represented the second coming of the Savior or anything of that kind, because a lot of people won't accept that. Especially when somebody gets through analyzing it. So then they must have had some kind of an argument. They decided they'd print this as a letter to the editor. And I said, you can shove that. I said, who writes letters to editors? I mean, fellows that have some kick about something. Fellows that are mad at somebody about something. Not me. I don't write your magazine or obscure magazine. Something of that kind. No, you print it as an article. The way I write it or leave it. I don't care what you do about it. But I got to the point now where I'm going to print it. So I found out that there were some people who would print it. But they were all scared. They've all gotten into the... they got to the feeling where you're laying an impious hand on the Ark of the Covenant, you know. It was terrible. You can't say anything about it. I wasn't saying anything nasty about him. A remarkable man, wonderful fellow in many ways. But I lived with his works here and in other places. 27 years in the city and 37 in the state, and I got to know something about it. So I thought, well, some years back, a fellow on the old Fortune magazine, when they were printing the kind of articles that later turned up in Life, got me to do a piece on Baron Osman, some anniversary there. Now you got something, kid. So I did this thing, and it was pretty widely copied all around. So I brought this stuff up to date, and I was comparing Osman to the other fellow. And when I got through, there wasn't much left of the other fellow. It's a long-range planner compared to the fellow who rebuilt Paris, all enfant in Washington. This cold-blooded analysis. That didn't mean that he wasn't a great man, that he didn't do a remarkable thing, but I couldn't take him at their valuation. So I sent this correspondence to a few people, and some distinguished landscape people got sore about it. And they said, why don't you print what this fellow writes? made him an honorary member, gave him a medal or something. I'd even forgotten what the details of that. So, 3 or 4 days ago, I hear from this editor, because I'd written a more or less facetious letter about it, saying, forget it, kid. I got other places to do this thing. I found there were at least three other places where I could print this. And I preferred to do it in some magazine where they were, not big circulation, but where the fellows would do some thinking and it gets around. I finally decided on Bill Buckley, and Bill is running it. So this fellow writes me a letter 3 or 4 days ago. The funniest letters you ever saw. They had changed their mind. They would run it just the way I said it, just exactly. And it would appear in such a way. I wrote back to him. I said, kid, I've already disposed of it. You're not in. Now, you have. It's a difficult thing to do that. It's the simple thing to do when there's 150 or 100th anniversary is to say that this is the greatest fellow that ever lived. Too bad he isn't around. Now, if you're talking about oases in the desert and occasional city parks, why, yes, this fellow was a great fellow in his own line. I studied him pretty goddamn carefully just for fun because I had a little spare time. You do have when you get into my niche or whatever the hell it is. For instance, I found out all about his life in Staten Island. He lived there for several years. I don't mean anything personal about it. I mean, did he have any idea of the future of Staten Island? No. Did he have any concept of what ought to be done to get ready for this thing? No. Not a concept. Not a glimmer. But he did some very nice work there. But it just didn't have any understanding of it. You run into those things and you either take them on and say, well, this is my estimate of the thing. You don't like it. That's okay with me. You all believe in the First Amendment. They all do, you know, theoretically, until you hit their friends. Then they don't believe in it at all anymore. So that's my answer to you. If you say, what did the fellow do in Central Park? He created a remarkable, artificial park out of nothing, a dump. That's what he did, in the middle of what proved to be New York, as New York grew. Beyond that, no. He didn't understand people either. He's a Boston Brahmin. He believed in the New England Protestant ethic. He sold on that. And he hated to go around the country and see people coming up from nothing. Particularly people who are not Anglo-Saxon Protestants. See, he got out of his works. Most people don't bother to study anybody long enough to get to the bottom of what motivated them. Therefore, he was incapable of understanding urban civilization.
You were parks commissioner for many years.
Yeah.
And now when you go into Central Park or many of the others, you see, of course,
the
I guess...
Wreck.
Yes, and graffiti almost everywhere, whether it's on the subway cars or the buses.
Yeah, but it's a wreck.
What do you do about the graffiti? Excellent. What do you do about things like this?
A new commissioner called me up, said he wanted to see me a few weeks ago. He spent a long time. Well, I said, Miss Clerman, I said, why'd you take this job? Why did you take it now? In a fading administration. 1 year. Well, a leave of absence. They don't give me that crap. I said, you're still down at time. You're vice president, stockholder, and so on. As for the birds. You know, I don't say you can't do this thing. Nobody could do it less than about 2 terms, 8 years. This is a wreck, this whole thing. I spent a lot of time going over this because he went around looking at things. He didn't do all the things I recommended to him. First thing he talked to me about was abandoning the areas that were not taken care of by the neighborhood. To hell with them. I said, you can't do that. That's stupid. What do you want to do that for? You'll be murdered when you make that announcement. Well, he made it anyhow. And he's sorry he made it. He's a nice guy. He took an awful beating from me, I'll tell you that. And he took it. I said, you got to study this thing very damn carefully. You have no idea how bad this is. Now, what are you anyhow? Are you a fellow who's interested in events like Augie Heckscher? Are you interested in Pabst plays? Are you interested in Two Gentlemen of Verona? Or in basketball and handball? You better give that some thought. He said, oh, no. He said, you know, I've been associated with you. I said, I know. You're chairman of the city center and all that kind of thing. Which are you going to do? You'll have to make up your mind. Oh, I'm going to be the athletic fellow. Well, I said, we'll see.
What do you do? What do you do about the parks?
Oh, well, that's a long, long story. But what you have to have is guts and the right people around you. It's no good just going into the arsenal and picking up papers and things of that kind, taking the graffiti off the wall. There are ways of doing these things. Let's see what he does. Give him a chance. He's certainly the best news that's been around in a long time. I'm for giving him every chance in the world. I kind of like the fellow. Hoagie never gave any time to this thing. Newbell Morris was all right if he lived. But look what happened to him. He told me that he was sure of reappointment, getting along with this other fellow. Old scroll and key stuff from Yale. I said, that fellow will throw you right out in the street, Newbold. Right out in the street. I can see it happening. Oh, well, he said, very, very cynical observation. Right, Newbold, you and I have been friends a long, long time. Get your Ostamore ready to land on, because that's where you're going. That's where he went. He couldn't believe it when it happened. He couldn't believe it. His wife couldn't believe it. He said, lousy ingrate down there. He doesn't care anything about these things. It's what you got. The people they brought in there in the park department, appalling. You have to have an instinct for it. You don't have the instinct, it isn't any good. You ride along, you see place in wreckage. Park. Never drive your own car if you're a public employee. Never. If you're driving your own car, you're not observing anything. You send for the fellow in charge and say, straw boss, or maybe anything. Foreman, this place is in bad shape. What happens now is that you call in somebody and he in turn calls up the fellow who got him the appointment and he calls the fellow in City Hall that takes care of it. And then the word comes to leave him alone. Study this thing. He has to have a trial and all that kind of thing. Nothing happens. In my day, I discover that the fellow had an appointment with destiny at the end of Staten Island, way up the end of the Bronx. See? For the good of the service. He was needed there. You know how long it takes to get that around, that word around? 24 hours. Everybody will be saying, look what that son of a bitch did.
Excluding automobiles for the moment, you had mentioned that the cities seem to be more unlivable now because of crime. What has changed the character of the cities over the people. Last century and a half century?
The people. The South dumps all of its problem children on New York, and they get same with Puerto Rico. What are you going to have? You're going to have a hell of a lot of people that are going to take a long, long while to absorb. I don't say you shouldn't take them, although in some cases I don't think you should. For example, if there was a way, and there was at one time, of providing for more people in Puerto Rico, down there, housing, proper housing, to prevent them coming up to places here where they had no facilities for them. That should have been done, but I couldn't get any help in working. I worked on it. I tried out all these things. I don't really talk about them. I've taken a lot of beatings in the process that I don't advertise.
Now that we have the problem, how do we solve it? Or can it be solved?
Oh, yes, I think so. Yes, I think it can be solved, but not the way they're going at it. Not with the most grotesquely incompetent mayor in my time. Not with a pretty boy. If you want that, vote for him. No, you've got to have a different approach to these things, but it's a tough business. New York has, speaking of New York, it has enormous natural advantages. Location. You know, the three great harbors of the world. Has the advantage of unusual collection of highly intelligent, competitive people. I don't think either one of those two things will save them unless they take on the law and order business and the outward order and decency, whatever you want to call it. They have to take that on. That's a tough thing, tough people.
I'd like to ask you some things about one of your more spectacular accomplishments, and that was the World's Fair. What kind of problems did you have in trying to make this fair successful, to generate its completion?
Well, that fair was one of those inheritances. See, I began with Flushing Meadow. I got the first fair put in Flushing Meadow. Need any question about that? You read that in the book. I sold the idea to LaGuardia when people talked to him about a fair, and they talked to him about this location. I said, let's take it over and make it the greatest park in New York out of it. And I got into it as a landlord. See, and Grover became the president of the fair. Long story about how that happened, we won't get into now.
Now, this was 39,
yes. Bridges, tunnels, approaches. Then later on, I insisted that if they have another World's Fair, that it be in Flushing Meadow. We begin cleaning up, doing all the things we hadn't been able to do. We just got land, salted it away, leftover stuff. We had a world's wall that broke out at that time. So I got in that again and got the presidency, with it a hell of a lot of headaches, and no very firm support from City Hall.
Why?
Why? Ask Wagner. He's a friend of mine. Ask him.
Was there opposition to the fair from its inception?
Well, yes. I don't say the opposition was anything as great as it was to the United Nations moving into the East Side. There's a lot of support, a tremendous opposition. There was only one member of the Board of Estimate who really wanted the United Nations on the East Side. Talk about the Board of Estimate now, not only the mayor. That was O'Dwyer. And nobody else wanted it. There's a misunderstanding about a lot of these things. Now, as to the Second World's Fair, it'd be hard for me to evaluate the opposition. The fact was that it wasn't so much opposition as it was unwillingness to stand up to the difficulties. For example, when people were going to throw themselves in front of automobiles in the fair. It's all in all the papers. Were they mad at us? Were they mad at the fair? No. They were mostly blacks who found a good place for a demonstration. What better place? Well, and the question is, how much would the police do about it? Well, we got into the row between the Israelis and the Jordanese. That was a nasty business. What support did I get there? I'll tell you what I got. I got the goddamnedest decoration you ever saw in your life. One other fellow got it. I guess it's certainly the only fellow that, in that time that got that decoration from all the Arab people. They were all there to celebrate this thing. People said to me, you can't go to a thing of that kind. You? Your name? Your background? You can kiss my ass. Of course I'm going there. I like this Jordanese king. I stood up on the thing. Did I get much support for it? Oh, boy, you should have been there. You see, the great trouble was, were no Arab votes. That's what I was up against. These Israeli fellows, they get away with murder. Fellows that come in and threaten you with things. You wouldn't believe it. That's the way it was. I had the respect of every goddamn Arab and every Jordanese that there was around. I still have it. I don't have the respect of Senator Javits, but that's okay with me. I can live any time without Javits.
Along with all of your accolades, you've had an an awful lot of abuse for many of your strong positions.
Yeah,
how do you? I'm going to ask you, how do you accept this?
It's just everybody has to go through that thing. I think the best statement ever made on the thing, at least the best I ever heard, was the one that Harry Truman made over and over again. If you can't stand the heat, stay out of the kitchen. That's the best. It's the most succinct thing. It's what he said, and he was right.
It never gave you sleepless nights.
Well, I don't know about that. Of course, that was a boast. But Adlai Stevenson, when he was in the United Nations, is a sensitive guy. I'm a hell of a nice fellow. I'm a hell of an able fellow. A superior fellow. Too goddamn superior for most of the voters. But there he was. And he was out the country in Long Island for a weekend. And mutual friend. And I was out just going out for supper. And I got there early. I was nursing a drink, sitting up in the West Hills. And Adlai came in like something a cat had dragged in. I said, for Christ's sake, what's the matter with you? Oh, gee, an awful day. That fellow Gromyko, you know, and all that stuff. You don't really need to say, Adlai, that this fellow bothers you. You'll wake up at night and think of what he said. What do you care what he said? Well, he says, that's all right for you to say that, but it's terrible. And just before the people came in, the other guests came in, he said, now listen, Bob, when you drop that crocodile hide, leave it to me. That was his trouble. He didn't have a crocodile hide. He didn't belong in that kind of public life. It's a damn shame that that's required if you want to get my opinion about it. But that's the way it is. In other words, you couldn't take it. Dish it, not take it.
When you reach a position on a given subject, apparently it's well thought out, do you recommend standing by this position?
Yeah.
And
yes,
fighting till it's death?
Yes. I hate compromise, but I will compromise if I can't get anything any other way. But I don't like it. I don't like it. You begin by being a compromiser, you're going to get nothing. But at times, that's what you have to do, to make a choice. Look at this thing here, right in front of you. You don't think that belonged here. That's Mr. Hurst, who was over there, Mr. Brisbane. This belonged down at 107th Street. They own the land there. I walked in there and got to the point where they had bought the land, where they had these great mounds of concrete here. And I said to my two associates on the commission, I said, what do we do about this thing? You want to bullet through? I'll go with you two fellas if you want to. I don't want to do that. I'm willing to move it up here. I'm willing to wreck these two institutions on Randall's Island. I'm willing to go all the way across Ward's Island to get this thing. And I expect you fellas will vote with me in the end. But it's wrong. I know it's wrong. You don't need to tell me it's wrong. It's what we did. It is. Anybody looking at the map? Look at the map. I have people come in here and they say something to me about it. An old woman came in here the other day and she said, I can't understand this thing. I can't understand this thing. Hearst's lawyer was a member of the tri-borough. They had to take him. Very nice fella, too.
But when you take...
He wasn't in favor of what we did.
When you
Who
take...
won both?
When you take strong positions on subjects, this is bound, obviously, to create enemies. Do you believe that this could be destructive, ultimately, to what you might want to accomplish? The fact that these enemies are waiting in the wings.
Sure, it happens all the time. The history of the entire development on Long Island, everything east of the city line, even within the city, Brooklyn and Queens, everything was fought all the way along. I run into people now who say, well, we were always for Jones Beach. Well, I have people that were the leaders of the opposition. Nobody in the Ku Klux Klan has yet left over, has kind of come around to tell me that they were always with me. But short of that, I don't mean that you're not so insensitive that things don't bother you. There are things that are hard to forget. Personal betrayals. No loyalty. I hate that. You know, my wife said to me yesterday about somebody, she said, you never forgotten this thing. I said, I never could. Never could forget this. So what he did was, what I'd done for him, what he did was gratuitous, nasty, dirty, lousy. No. I never forgive that fellow. I don't bother about him. It doesn't bother me.
You went to Germany after World War II to help reconstruct that nation. Can you tell me about your experiences there?
Let me give you the background. The fellow who recommended that to General Clay, and Clay's top man, that picture was Marshall, of course. Well, the fellow I'd worked with a good deal, he's retired now. He was an inside advisor on everything that had to do with public works. Never got credit for what he did, and his name was Madigan, Jack Madigan. He was a saloon keeper's son from up in Connecticut. Remarkable guy. And he knew that I had some relatives and had connections over there, had in Germany, and I knew that part of Germany fairly well. I once went to school there to learn German for a few months. And he said, why don't you get this fellow, the Clay, come over here and look at the Ruhr Valley particularly and what's going on there, the mines and so forth. And Clay thought that was a good stunt and got me to come over. I was already there briefly. He assigned a fellow to work with me, son of a judge who was over there, very able fellow, a diplomatic service. But I did have the advantage of knowing where I was and what had been going on, what a community it was, and the Krupps and all the rest of that thing, which very few people had. So when the report was finished, Clay didn't know quite what to do with it. He some doubt as to whether, question as to whether it wouldn't raise some hell, one kind or another. I don't think that Lucius was afraid of that, but he didn't know what to do about it. He wanted to let it, you know, be kicked around. I said, this thing's kicked around in Washington, you know, nobody will ever see it. So I went to Bernie Baruch, and I told him the story. Next day it was released. That's how it got out. Otherwise, it never would have been released. Now, as to how good it was, what good it did, I have to ask Clay that. There's one thing about it that Lucius and I had quite a scrap about it. Sat up most of one night talking about the lenders, they call them, these lands, the American governors and so forth and so on. Clay talked to me about, Murphy was there, Bob Murphy, he lived around the corner, he really controlled the situation for the, actually that department, the state really controlled the whole thing, truth be told.